which was the size and shape of an old-fashioned oven, and at the front, a pair of glass eyepieces jutted out along hollow stalks. I examined all the exhibits in turn. Inside each one, underneath the item it represented, was a sign clumsily lettered by hand, giving a title. Exhibit 1. I have been here before. The legs of a woman raised and open as if to admit a lover formed a curvilinear triumphal arch. The feet were decorated with spike-heeled black leather pumps. This anatomical section, composed of pinkish wax, dimpled at the knee, did not admit the possibility of the existence of a torso. A bristling pubic growth rose to form a kind of coat of arms above the circular proscenium it contained at either side, but although the hairs had been inserted one by one in order to achieve the maximal degree of verisimilitude, the overall effect was one of stunning artifice. The dark red and purple crenellation surrounding the vagina acted as a frame for a perfectly round hole through which the viewer glimpsed the moist, luxuriant landscape of the interior. Here, endlessly receded before one's eyes, a miniature but irresistible vista of semi-tropical forest, where amazing fruits hung on the trees. While from the dappled and variegated chalices of enormous flowers the size of millstones, perfumes of such extraordinary potency that they had become visible to the eye exuded as soft purple dew. Small, brilliant birds trilled silently on the branches. Animals of exquisite shapes and colors, among them unicorns, giraffes, and herbivorous lions, cropped up buttercups and daisies from the impossibly green grass. Butterflies, dragonflies, and innumerable jeweled insects fluttered, darted, or scurried among the verdure, so all was in constant movement. And besides, the very vegetation was continually transforming itself. As I watched, the pent-up force of the sweet juice within it burst open a persimmon, and the split skin let out a flight of orange tawny singing birds. An elongated bud on the point of opening must have changed its mind, for it turned into a strawberry instead of a water lily. A fish sprang out of the river, became a white rabbit, and bounded away. It seemed that winter and rough winds would never touch these bright, oblivious regions, or ripple the surface of the lucid river which wound a tranquil course down the central valley. The eye of the beholder followed the course of this river upwards towards the source, and so it saw, for the first time, after some moments of delighted looking, the misty battlements of a castle. The longer one looked at the dim outlines of this castle, the more sinister it grew, as though its granite viscera housed as many tortured chambers as the Chateau of Ceiling. The rest of the machines contain the following items. Exhibit 2, The Eternal Vistas of Love. When I looked through the windows of the machine, all I could see were two eyes looking back at me. Each eye was a full 3 feet from end to end, complete with a lid and a tear duct, and was suspended in the air without any visible support. Like the pubic hair in the previous model, the lashes had been scrupulously set one by one in narrow hems of rosy wax, but this time the craftsman had achieved a disturbing degree of lifelikeness which uncannily added to the synthetic quality of the image. The rounded whites were delicately veined with crimson to produce an effect like that of the extremely precious marble used in Italy during the late Baroque period to make altars for the chapels of potentates. and the irises were simple rings of deep brown bottle glass, while in the pupils I could see, reflected in two discs of mirror, my own eyes, very greatly magnified by the lenses of the machine. Since my own pupils in turn reflected the false eyes before me, while these reflections again reflected those reflections, I soon realized I was watching a model of eternal regression. Exhibit 3. The Meeting Place of Love and Hunger. Upon a cut glass dish of the kind in which desserts are served, lay two perfectly spherical portions of vanilla ice cream, each topped with a single cherry, so that the resemblance to a pair of female breasts was almost perfect. Exhibit 4. Everyone knows what the night is for. Here a wax figure of the headless body of a mutilated woman lay in a pool of painted blood. She wore only the remains of a pair of black stockings and a ripped suspender belt of shiny black rubber. Her arms stuck out stiffly on either side of her, and once again I noticed the loving care with which the craftsman who manufactured her had simulated the growth of underarm hair. The right breast had been partially segmented and hung open to reveal two surfaces of meat as bright and false as the plaster sirloins which hang in toy butchers' shops, while her belly was covered with some kind of paint that always contrived to look wet, and from the paint emerged the handle of an enormous knife, which was kept always a-quiver by the action, probably, of spring. Exhibit 5. Trophy of a Hunter in the Forests of the Night. A head purporting, presumably, to have been taken from the victim of the preceding tableau, hung in the air. Again, with no strings or hook in sight to reveal how this position was maintained. From the point of severance dripped slow gouts of artificial blood, plop, plop, plop. But the receptacle into which they fell was outside the viewer's field of vision. A very abundant black wig tumbled around her pallid features, which wore a hideous expression of resignation. Her eyes were closed. Exhibit 6, The Key to the City. A candle in the shape of a penis of excessive size with scrotum attached in a state of pronounced tumescence. The wrinkled foreskin was drawn far enough back to uncover in its importunate entirety the grossly swollen sunset-colored tip as far as a portion of the shaft itself, and at the minute cranny in the center where a wick must have been lodged, burned a small pure flame. As the viewer watched, the candle tipped forward on its balls and pointed towards one accusingly. I was struck with the notion that this was supposed to represent the minister's penis. Exhibit 7, Perpetual Motion. As I expected, here a man and a woman were conducting sexual congress on a black horsehair couch. The figures, again exquisitely executed in wax, looked as though they might have been modeled in one piece, and, due to a clockwork mechanism hidden in their couch, they rocked continually back and forth. This coupling had a fated, inevitable quality. One could not picture a cataclysm sufficiently violent to rend the twin forms asunder. And neither could one conceive of a past beginning, for they were so firmly joined together, it seemed they must have been formed in this way at the beginning of time, and, locked in parallel, would go on thus forever to infinity. They were not so much erotic as pathetic, poor palmers of desire who never budged as much as an inch on their endless pilgrimage. The man's face was molded into the woman's neck, and so could not be seen. But the head of the woman was constructed so as to oscillate in the socket of her neck, and as it rolled from side to side, her face was intermittently visible. I recognized this face instantly, although it was fixed in the tormented snarl of orgasm. I remained staring at it for some time. It was the beautiful face of Dr. Hoffman's ambassador. The old man interrupted my reverie. His voice was as raucous as a rooster's. "Is there enough money in my saucer to buy me a bottle?" he demanded. "I'll buy you a drink with pleasure," I said. Thank you kindly," he replied, and painfully heaved himself to his feet. He fumbled around in his corner until he finally produced a peaked cap of the style worn by Lenin and the Bolsheviks. When he had set this jauntily on his head, he began another search, but I soon uncovered his white stick for him. Now the pier was peopled. A ragged youth with cake snot in the grooves under his nose stood behind the rifle range idly probing the inside of his ear with a piece of twig. And a blousy woman in rayon slip, with hair dyed the color of apricots, yawned and scratched her buttocks at the entrance to the fortune-teller's booth. Three little boys clung to the rails by their feet, holding fishing rods over the sea with one hand, and in the other hand clutched jam jars of water by the string handles tied round the rims. The beach, too, presented an everyday holiday panorama of frisking dogs, children building sandcastles, and a great deal of skin exposed to the sun. But all these Johnny-come-latelys had the yawning, vacant air of those just awakened from a deep sleep, and walked uncertainly, sometimes for no reason, breaking into a stumbling run, and then halting just as suddenly to stare around them with startled, empty eyes, or turning to speak to a companion. They would stop, mouth ajar, as if they no longer recognized him. And for so great a number of people, they made very little noise, as if they knew they had no existential right to be here. The peep show proprietor was blind and lame, but he certainly knew his way about the town and led me unerringly to a small bar, so deep inside the fisherman's quarter, the streets no longer bothered to keep up appearances, and relapsed thankfully into slumminess. We sat down at a marble-topped table, and without waiting for our order, a black brought us two glasses of the crude spirit that passes for brandy among the poor. He left the bottle on the table. The peep-show proprietor emptied his glass at a draught.
"The purpose of my display," he remarked, "is to demonstrate the difference between saying and showing. Signs speak. Pictures show."
I filled up his glass again for him, and he thanked me by leaning across the table and comprehensively stroking my face with his gnarled fingertips, as if learning my dimensions before sculpting me.
"Who sent you?" he said abruptly.
"I have come to investigate the disappearance of the mayor," I replied guardedly.
"Ah, yes," he said. "She sits like Marianna in the moated grange, poor girl. Marianne, the beautiful somnambulist."
He drank again more slowly and then remarked,
"My life is nothing but a wind-blown rag."
With that, he fell silent. I was to learn he spoke only in a series of disconnected, often gnomic statements, usually tinged with melancholy, bitterness, self-pity, or all three together. I sipped my eau de vie quietly and waited for him to speak again. After the third glass, he did.
"I was not Mendoza. I never had that honor."
"Who were you, then?" he became bashful and secretive.
Once I was a very important man indeed, even you might say a great man. Once they used to take off their hats to me as I walked down the road and marvel to me ingratiatingly. And barmen were glad of my custom, yes, proud and glad, instead of merely sullenly tolerating me.
The barman, who must have heard all this many times before, flashed his teeth and smiled at me as if to create complicity. I poured more brandy into the old man's glass.
They used to say, "We're honored to have you honor us with your presence, Professor."
And then he stopped, as though he knew he had already said too much, which was perfectly true. He had given me the principal letters of a clue, and now I had only to fill in the blanks. I made an initial guess. The greatest success a teacher can boast is the pupil who surpasses him.
"Then why has he humiliated me so?" wailed the old man, and I know instantly he had taught elementary physics to Dr. Hoffman at the university all those years ago. When he finished the fifth glass, the last vestiges of his discretion vanished. "He doesn't even allow me to work in the laboratories. He gave me a set of samples and let me loose, left me to wander up and down, here and there, hither and thither, pushing my wheelbarrow in front of me, tripping over stones and rotting my guts with fetid liquor."
"His set of samples?"
"Plenty more in my sack," he said. "Lots and lots of samples. Dozens and scores and hundreds and thousands of samples. You'd think they breed in there and I just put them in the machines, don't I? And stick a sign along with them, and sometimes people pay, and sometimes they don't. And sometimes they scream, and sometimes they giggle. And sometimes the police turn me out of town, and off I go down the road again, pushing my barrow. And times grow worse since he began to put it into practice. No more money to spare for an old man's disgusting, if didactic, demonstrations. You can get as good at home. Soon I have to charge a pin to see it, or a jam jar, or a cigarette card. And who will exchange such rubbish for liquor then? When that day dawns, poor Robin must tuck his head under his wing, poor thing, and pretend to be warm, yes. But," he added, pulling out the seventh glass for himself, "the singular privilege of becoming Mendoza was never granted me. I was allowed to make my own transformations. And if you look at me, you can see how well I have succeeded."
A tear trickled out from under his glasses so that I knew he had eyes, even if they were sightless. And I seemed to remember a cutting in the fires that said Dr. Hoffman's old professor had suffered some injuries in an accident in a laboratory many, many years before. I judged the old man was now sufficiently drunk and handed the bottle back to the barman.
"I should like to kill him," said the peep show proprietor. "If I were 10 years younger, I would go to the castle and murder him."
"Do you know the way to the castle?"
"I should follow my nose," he said.
But then a cock crowed, and a sound affected the old man curiously. He sat up and listened attentively. It crowed a second time and then a third.
"Get thee behind me, Satan!" shrieked the old man.
With that, he struck me full in the face with his cane, so that blood streamed into my eyes from a cut above my forehead, and when I could see again, he was gone. I hurried immediately back to the pier, but, though I could only hobble, I caught no sign of him along the way. And when I reached the place where his booth had been, it was, of course, also completely gone. So I made my way to the town hall to do my official business. The plaster scrolls and garlands on the pompous exterior of the town hall were crumbling like dry sponge cake. and all the windows were screened with green blinds, but the heavy mahogany doors swung open readily enough, and though puffs of dust rose up when I trod on the maroon plush carpeting, and most of the offices were empty but for cobwebs spun from inkwell to pen rack across blurred surfaces of desks, at last a yawning clerk came out of the anteroom of the mayor's office to greet me. Metal bracelets hoisted up his shirt sleeves to bare his wrists for work. He had been left in charge. The mayor's office itself was a mausoleum. It had been tidied since he left, so there were no papers or files to be seen, and they had drawn his carved, pompous chair so tightly up to the scrupulously denuded desk that it looked as though it were denying admittance there to any future body. The mayor's pink blotter was thickly furred with mildew, and his dried-out water flask, topped with an inverted tumbler, had grown hunched shoulders of settled dust. The indefatigable spiders had woven a canopy across the photograph of the late president on the wall. The clerk opened a cupboard to reveal a decanter full of mayoral sherry, now grown viscous as treacle, groped on a lower shelf, and produced the fur-collared overcoat the mayor had left behind him on the snowy morning he vanished. The pockets contained only a single bald glove and a dirty handkerchief, nothing of significance. But after only the briefest search through the other offices, I found evidence that a certain peep-show proprietor had filed an official request to open a booth on the pier in the preceding month of April. This four, signed with a tentative cross, still waited for the official stamp. So my ramshackle friend had clearly gone ahead on his own and set up shop regardless. It was at least a connection. I tucked away this form to take back to the minister, took the clerk's name and briefly checked his reality rating with my information. It appeared satisfactory. Then I asked him to ring the mayor's home, where his daughter still lived with a housekeeper. The clerk got through after only 7 or 8 minutes, and I noted the services were still functioning satisfactorily, though the clerk told me the telephone switchboard could neither take nor receive calls outside the immediate neighborhood, while even these local calls were constantly interrupted by voices in unknown languages. After a good deal of country town chat with the mayor's house, he ensured me some night's lodging there, at the probable source of my bureaucratic mystery. "It's all got very run down since the mayor left," he said dubiously. "Just the old woman and the girl." Something in his voice indicated a strangeness in the girl. I pricked up the ears of my mind, briskly jotted down the directions he gave me, and went to my car. It was now early evening, and since I stopped on my way to eat a supper of meat pies in a fly-blown cafe too squalid to be illusory, I did not reach the house until it was almost dark. It lay some way out of town at the end of an old-fashioned rutted lane, where there were no other habitations than one abandoned barn. The sky was the tender, transparent blue of a late summer's night, and a slender intimation of the moon hung above a copse of fir, although the tiger lilies of the setting sun still growled in the west. I parked my car in the road, and once the engine ceased to throb, there was no other sound but a faint shimmer of birdsong and the rattle of the quilled boughs of the pines. Although I knew it was inhabited, at first I thought the house was quite forsaken, for the extensive garden which surrounded it was sunk in the neglect of years. Whoever made the garden first must have loved roses, but now the roses had quite overrun the garden and formed dense, forbidding hedges that sent out such an overpowering barrage of perfume that my head was soon swimming. Besides, roses sprayed out fanged, blossoming whips from copulas which almost foundered under their weight. Roses reared up in groves of sturdy standards now the size of young oaks, and roses sent vine-like tendrils along the somber branches of yew trees, of ornamental rowans, of cherry trees, and apple trees already half suffocated with mistletoe. So this summer, which had suited roses so well, seemed to have conspired with the gardener to produce an orgiastic jungle of all kinds of roses. And though I could not distinguish any of their separate shapes or colors, their individual scents all blended into a single intolerably sweet essence, which made every nerve in my body ache and tingle. Roses had climbed up the already luxuriantly ivied walls and lodged in knots on the roofs, where flowering weeds were rooted in the gaps between the mossy tiles, while a great unlopped elm with lice of rooks in its hair towered over the house as if about to drop its great limbs upon it to smash it, while at the same time its roots clutched the foundations under the earth in a ferocious embrace. The gardener had laid claim to the house and was destroying it at its arborescent leisure. Those within the halls were already at the capricious mercy of nature. Enormous clumps of mugwort had torn apart the gate and blocked the path entirely, so I had to clamber over the tumble-down wall, dislodging a few more stones as I did so. Looking towards the shaggy outlines of the house, I saw a greenish glimmer of light on the ground floor filtering through the leaves which obscured the windows, and took this for my clue out of the hostile vegetable maze which, as I moved forward, lashed me, scored me, stung me, and left me sick, bleeding, and dizzy with its odorous excess. As I drew nearer to the house, I heard over the pounding of the blood in my ears notes of music falling plop, like goldfish in a quiet pool. Breathless, I halted for a moment to find out if the sound was true. It went wistfully on. Somebody in that ruinous place was playing Debussy on the piano. At last I reached the lighted window, and parting the foliages which covered it, I peered through. I saw a drawing room with worn Persian rugs on the floor, and walls hung with a once crimson brocaded paper that was now faded and figured with damp and mold, rucking and buckling over the dank walls beneath. There was an alabaster fireplace with a bouquet of shell flowers in a misted glass dome upon it, and a fan of silver paper in the grate. Oil paintings so heavily varnished one could not make out their subjects hung here and there askew in pompous frames of tarnished gilt, and an unlit cut-glass chandelier in the center of the ceiling scintillated with reflections from the two candles in a branched stick, which stood on the grand piano and threw a soft light over the girl who played it. Her back was turned towards me, but when I craned my neck, I could see her white, thin, nervous fingers on the keyboard, and caught a glimpse of the pale curve of her cheek. Her hair, the lifeless brown of a winter forest, hung down the back of her black dress. She played with extraordinary sensitivity. The room was full of a poignant, nostalgic anguish which seemed to emanate from that slender figure whose face I could not see. I thought it best not to disturb her, and made my way round to the back of the house, where I found a black cat washing itself on an upturned bucket, and inside an open door, a fat old woman who sat in a darkened kitchen to save, she said, the electricity. And that was also the reason why she made the mistress of the house play the piano by candlelight. The housekeeper guessed who I must be from my lumpy shape in the shadows. She greeted me warmly and turned on the lights in my honor to reveal a blessedly commonplace kitchen with a gas stove, a refrigerator, and a saucer of milk put down for Pussy. She settled me down at the scrub table with a cup of tea and a saucer full of shortbread biscuits, asked about my journey, and hoped, too solicitously, that I would find the accommodation adequate.
How could we put you up luxuriously, sir? I mean, in the circumstances.
She had a slippery, ingratiating quality which is meant to disarm, but somehow offended me. And she loquaciously set sail on a rattling stream of nothings, while the girl in the drawing room continued to play the piano exquisitely, and the music echoed down the corridor into the room. The old woman spoke of the vanished mayor with neither embarrassment nor surmise. She had apparently absorbed the fact that he was gone so well into her world that if one day he returned, she would feel subtly affronted. She hinted that she suspected a woman might be behind it, for she said,
"Not many women would want Marianne for a stepdaughter. Oh, no, oh, no."
She rolled her eyes significantly and chatted on about the difficulty of obtaining women's magazines and knitting wool. Presently the music ceased, and Marianne herself came into the kitchen on some errand she forgot as soon as she saw me, for the housekeeper had not bothered to tell her an unexpected guest would arrive at her home. She stood in the doorway, transfixed with surprise and apprehension. In her face, only eyes the color of a rainy day moved this way and that, as if looking for a way out. She had the waxen delicacy of a plant bred in a cupboard. She did not look as if blood flowed through her veins, but instead some other less emphatic fluid, infinitely less red. Her mouth was barely touched with palest pink, though it had exactly the proportions of the three cherries the art master piles in an inverted triangle to illustrate the classic mouth, and there was no tinge of any pink at all in her cheeks. Now she was standing up, she was almost hidden in her dress, and her tiny face, shaped like a locket, looked even smaller than it was, because of a disordered profusion of hair streaming down as straight as if she had just been plucked from the river. I could see her hair and dress were stuck all over with twigs and petals from the garden. She looked like drowning Ophelia. I thought so immediately, though I could not know how soon she would really drown, for she was so forlorn and desperate. And a chilling and restrained passivity made her desperation all the more pathetic. The housekeeper clucked to see the wraith-like girl's bare feet.
"Put your slippers on at once, miss. Bare feet on these stone flags. I never did. You'll catch your death."
Marianne moved awkwardly from one foot to the other, as if her chances of catching death from the stone floor of the kitchen were halved if only one foot came in contact with it at a time. She was about 17. Her distant gaze wandered vaguely over the table, and she whispered in a pleading undertone,
"Perhaps a little tea?"
"Not unless you step onto the rag rug," said the housekeeper.
Too authoritatively for the circumstances, perhaps. And the girl edged into the room until she stood on the bright strip of carpet, allowing her eyes to rest on me again while the housekeeper got her a cup and even a biscuit, although she muttered to herself as she did so.
I am Marianne, the mayor's daughter. Who are you?
I am a civil servant, and my name is Desiderio. She repeated the name quietly to herself, but with a curious quiver in her voice, which might have been pleasure, and eventually she confided,
Desiderio, the desired one, did you know you have eyes just like an Indian?
The housekeeper went tisk-tisk with annoyance, for we whites were not supposed to acknowledge the Indians.
My mother always found it embarrassing, I replied,
and at that the girl seemed obscurely pleased, and thrust out her hand in such a sudden, unexpected gesture of goodwill. It was more like a thwarted blow than an offer to shake. But I took her hand and found it was icy. She would not let go of me for a long time.
Mr. Desiderio is going to stay in the spare room for a while, said the housekeeper grudgingly, as if reluctant to share the information with her mistress. He's come from the government.
Marianne found this very mysterious. Her eyes grew wide.
You won't find my mother, you know, she informed me.
Why not? I asked. My fingers were still in the snow trap of her clutch.
If he didn't come back in time to prune the roses, he won't come back at all, she said,
and shook with such silent but vigorous laughter, her tea slopped from her cup onto her dress, which was already stained with all manner of other spilled food and drink.
What do you think happened to him, Marianne?
I asked gently, for though I knew from the records and my own intuition she was quite real, I had never before met a woman who looked so conversant with shadows as she.
He disintegrated, of course, she said. He resolved to his constituents, a test tube of amino acids, a tuft or two of hair.
She gestured with her cup for more tea. She had not given me any answer I might have expected, and when I tried to question her further, she only giggled again and shook her head so that a twist of apple leaves fell to the floor and her hair flopped over her eyes. Then she put her cup down on the table with the excessive care of the born clumsy and ran up the dark corridor again. She must have left the door of the drawing room open, for her piano sounded louder this time. And she must have changed her music for some irrational reason. Now she played the lucid nonsense of Eric Satie. With a sigh, the housekeeper gathered up the cups.
A screw loose, she said. A piece missing.
Soon she took me to a bed with a patchwork quilt in a simple but pleasant room at the back of the house. It was a soft, warm night, and the girl at her piano picked out an angular fretwork of audible lace on the surface of my first sleep. I think I woke because the music stopped. Perhaps her candles had burned out. Now the moon had fully risen and shone straight into my room through the screen of ivy and roses, so that dappled shadows fell with scrupulous distinction on the bed and the walls and the floor. Inside looked like the negative of a photograph of outside, and the moon had already taken a black and white picture of the garden. I awoke instantly and completely, with no residue of sleep in my mind, as though this was the proper time for me to wake, although it could only have been a little past midnight. I was too wakeful to stay in bed, and got restlessly up to look out of the window. The grounds were far more extensive than I had at first thought, and those behind the house were even further on the way to wilderness than those through which I had passed. The moon shone so brightly there was not a single dark corner, and I could see the dried-up bed of a large pond or small lake, which was now an oval of flat-petaled lilies, while the roses had entirely engulfed in their embrace a marble Undine, who reclined on her side in a touching attitude of provincial gracefulness.
delineated with the precision of a woodcut in the moonlight.
A family of young foxes rolled and tumbled with one another on a clearing which had been a lawn. There was no wind. The night sighed beneath the languorous weight of its own romanticism. I do not think she made a sound to startle me, but all at once I grew conscious of a presence in the room, and the cold sweat pricked the back of my neck. Slowly I turned from the window. She lived on the crepuscular threshold of life, and so I remember her as if standing always hesitantly in a doorway, like an unbidden guest, uncertain of her welcome. Her eyes were open but blind, and she held a rose in her outstretched fingers. She had taken off her plain black dress and wore a white calico nightgown such as convent schoolgirls wear. As I went towards her, so she came to me, and I took the rose because she seemed to offer it to me. A thorn under the leaves pierced my thumb, and I felt the red rose throb like a heart, and I saw it emit a single drop of blood, as if, like a sin-eater, it had taken on the pain of the wound for me. She wound her insubstantial arms around me and put her mouth on mine. Her kiss was like a draught of cold water, and yet immediately excited my desire, for it was full of an anguished yearning. I led her to the bed, and in the variegated shadows penetrated her sighing flesh, which was as chill as that of a mermaid, or of the marmoreal water maiden in her own garden. I was aware of a curiously attenuated response, as if she were feeling my caresses through a veil. And you must realize that all this time I was perfectly well aware she was asleep, for, apart from the evidence of my senses, I remembered how the peep show proprietor had talked of a beautiful somnambulist. Yet, if she was asleep, she was dreaming of passion. And afterwards I slept without dreaming, for I had experienced a dream in actuality. When I woke in the commonplace morning, nothing was left of her in the bed but some dead leaves, and there was no sign she had been in the room except for a withered rose in the middle of the floor. Marianne did not appear at breakfast, though the housekeeper supplied me so amply with eggs, bacon, sausages, pancakes, coffee, and fruit that I guessed, for whatever reasons, she was well satisfied with her houseguest. In the bright light of morning, the old woman's plump, lugubrious face looked indefinably sinister, even malign. She pressed me to return to the mayor's house for supper, and at last, to quiet her, I agreed to do so and gave 7 o'clock as the probable hour of my return, although I did not know if I would still be in the town at that time. When I went to my room to collect my briefcase, I passed an open door and, glancing inside, saw my nocturnal visitant sitting in front of a dressing-table mirror in an untidy room full of scores. She was still in her austere night shift as she gave her tangled hair its probably single combing of the day. Marianne, she smiled at me remotely in the mirror, and I knew she was awake. "Good morning, Desiderio," she said. "I hope you had a good night's sleep." I was bewildered. "Yes," I stammered. "Oh, yes." "Though occasionally people are frightened by the nightingales because they make such a noise sometimes." "Marianne, did you dream last night?" Her comb caught in a knot, and she tugged it impatiently.
I dreamed about a love suicide, she said. But then I always do. Don't you think it would be very beautiful to die for love? It is always disquieting to talk with a person in a mirror. Besides, the mirror was contraband. Her voice was high and clear, and, though she always talked softly, very sweetly piercing, like the sight of the moon in winter. I'm not at all sure it would be beautiful to die for anything, I said. One only resolves to one's constituents, she said, with a trace of precocious pedantry. I stepped into the room, leaving a crude trail of heavy footprints on her white carpet, and lifting her hair, I bent to kiss the nape of her neck. As I did so, I saw my own reflection for the first time since the beginning of the war. I saw that I had aged a little and was now as cynical as a satyr in a Renaissance painting. My face, poor mother, had all the inscrutability of the Indian. I greeted myself like a friend. Marianne allowed me to kiss her, but I do not think she noticed it. What will you do today, Marianne? Today, I shall play the piano, of course, unless I think of something better to do, that is. And I do not know if, for a moment, I saw another person glanced briefly out of her eyes, for I was not looking at her in the mirror, only myself. By the time I left the house, it had become a musical box, for she was already playing. Now she was practicing Chopin's Etudes. By daylight I could see the house was very large, one of those rambling country houses, half farmhouse and half mansion, though it must already have been three-quarters tumbled down when the mayor itself lived there. For whole sections of the roof had caved in beneath the monstrous burden of vegetation upon it, while what had once been stables and outhouses now lay open to the weather, and nature had already thrown too quick a green blanket over them to have been woven in only a few months. In the pure light of the morning, the fallen bricks, the exposed beams, the roses and the trees still seemed to sleep, murmuring and stirring a little as if a vague, unmemorable dream disturbed a slumber as profound as that of their mistress, the beauty in the dreaming wood, who slept too deeply to be wakened by anything as gentle as a kiss. I slipped into the town hall and glanced desultorily once more through the mayor's files, but I could find nothing that threw any further light on a disappearance I was now inclined to believe was quite unconnected with Dr. Hoffman. But just a simple suicide, which might have taken place anywhere, at any time, on the spur of a despairing moment. For somehow I guessed the mayor had been prone to anguish. When I had satisfied the conditions of my post as an inspector of veracity, I once again left the town hall in the sole hands of the yawning clerk, and went to the bar where the picture proprietor had taken me. But even the massive black presided there no longer. Only a golden girl far more Indian than I, in a skimpy dress of bright striped cotton, wiped glasses as she stared aimlessly at the sunlight in the streets outside, where only blowflies buzzed in the choked gutters, and, though I described the peep-show proprietor to her, she did not remember ever seeing him. So I downed a single brandy, and then sauntered along the promenade, a place now dedicated solely to the joys of summer, although these joys were undertaken with a singular, silent listlessness. As I leaned on the iron railing gazing out over the prim corrugations of the ocean, I heard a tapping behind me. As inconspicuously as I could, I looked around. He scuttled past me, accompanied by the staccato rattle of his cane, muttering to himself,
At a discreet distance, I followed him. I cannot begin to describe his crabbed, crouched, scrambling walk. How first he tapped with his cane, then set it upon the ground and half swung himself forward on it with a wheezing, triumphant gaze, as if at every step he defied and vanquished the ordinary laws of motion. He managed to perform these senile acrobatics with immense speed, as if there were springs in his stick and the worn heels of his boots, too. He was indescribably filthy. He might have spent the night in a sewer. He had moved his pitch to a dreary quarter of creosoted warehouses in which, from the stench, dried fish was stored. At the end of the alley, hung with banners of washing, was a small shrine to a fisherman's Madonna with a few dead flowers stuck before it, in a chipped Coca-Cola bottle, and behind it, a little bare plot of grass, now almost filled by the familiar pink-striped tent. And here I lost him. One moment he was there, hopping jerkily through the thick berries of wet laundry, and the next he was gone, slipped perhaps into one of the hovels along the way. So I decided to wait for him in his own booth for a while. This time, the poster read, "See a young girl's most significant experience in lifelike colors." To while away the time, I strolled from machine to machine, unaccountably disturbed by the things I saw there, although, unlike the seven wonders of yesterday's world, none contained any element of the grotesque. All were as haunting as the cards in tarot, and the very titles of each set piece were set in an integral medallion into each elegant design. These new tableaus were not, like yesterday's, models, but actual pictures painted with luscious oils on rectangular plates, in such a way that the twin eyepieces of the machine created a stereoscopic effect. These plates were arranged in several layers which slid in and out of one another by means of a system of programmed clockwork, which announced itself with a faint click and gave the impression of stilted movement in the figures. It also allowed sudden transformation scenes. Each picture was lit from behind and glowed with an unnatural brilliance, so that the moonlight which suffused the first scene was far more luxuriously pure than everyday moonlight, and looked like the platonic perfection of moonlight. This transcendental radiance bathed ivied ruins, and the slide shifted back and forth to allow bats to flit stiffly around them. A lugubrious owl perched on the crumbling chimney stack and slowly beat its wings upon the darkened air, where hung in iridescent characters the words, "The Mansion of Midnight." In the second machine, the mansion split in half to reveal a crimson room and a warning, "Hush, she is sleeping." She was as white as my last night's anemic lover, and like her, she was dressed in black. But this one had a medieval gown of sheer black velvet, with sleeves that came to points in the backs of her hands, while her streaming hair contained several shades of darkness. She lay back in the voluptuous abandonment of sleep, in a carved armchair where spiders propelled themselves up and down on the high wires they had spun themselves among the hangings. When I looked into the third machine, I saw a ferocious hedge of thorns. But then, before my very eyes, a young prince, with juicy bunches of golden ringlets hanging on the shoulders of his slashed and padded doublet, was superimposed on the hedge in a balletic attitude of pleading,
and from his mouth issued a scroll which read, I come. The hedge parted forthwith to reveal, in a set of cunning perspectives, the sleeper inside the haunted house of the first machine complete, with owl above, etc. A kiss can wake her. In the crimson room, the pretty prince, with skin as pink as sugar candy and lips like strawberry ice cream, bent over the sleeping girl. Another slide slipped into place and showed them so close together, his ringlets mixed with her locks and his face pressed so close to hers, her pallor took his color and blushed. A click of the internal mechanism. The tints of warm flesh rushed back into her face. Her eyes opened. Her newly red lips parted. With that, the poignant charm vanished. Inside the fifth machine, all was a rampant malignancy. Deformed flowers thrust monstrous horned tusks and trumpets, ending in blaring teeth, through the crimson walls, rending them. The ravenous garden slavered over its prey, and every brick was shown in the act of falling. Amid the violence of this transformation, the oblivion of the embrace went on. The awakened girl, in all her youthful loveliness, still clasped in the arms of a lover from whom all the flesh had fallen. He was a grinning skeleton. In one set of phalanges he carried a scythe, and with the other pulled out and squeezed a ripe breast from the girl's bodice, where his bony knees nudged apart her thighs. The emblem read, Death and the Maiden. The remaining two machines were empty. It was now in the middle of the day, and the heat inside the tent grew oppressive. I went outside and sat on a doorstep smoking and waiting, but still there was no sign of the peep-show proprietor. A child with crinkled hair tied up in the innumerable pigtails the poor and superstitious adopt for, I think, reasons of voodoo, approached and stared at me. Her plaits were so tight they revealed wide areas of the glossy brown skin covering her skull, and, though I questioned her, she answered me incomprehensibly in the multilingual patois of the slums, and began to poke indifferently in a clogged drain with a stick. Her face was covered with the whorled eruptions of a skin disease. The good nuns had taken me away from such pastimes and such afflictions, but all the same, you will have noticed I possessed a degree of ambivalence towards the minister's architectonic vision of the perfect state. This was because I was aware of what would have been my own position in that watertight schema. No shadows fell in the drowsy noonday. I inquired at several houses, but even those who spoke the standard language knew nothing of the peep-show proprietor, except that his booth had suddenly arrived in the shrine garden the previous evening. My shirt was soaked with sweat, and at last I walked down to the ocean to catch the possibility of a breeze. I wondered if all the holidaymakers were nothing but phantoms. Nevertheless, most of them had dispersed for lunch and an afternoon nap, and the beaches were again deserted. I strolled beside the margin of the water among the detritus of discarded sandals and plastic suntan lotion jars the sea could not digest, watching the dancing white lace hems of the petticoats of the ocean. And so, while I was thinking of nothing but sunshine, the breakers delivered her to my feet. Marianne had indeed found something else to do that day besides play the piano. And now she had suffered a sea change already. She was wreathed and garlanded in seaweed, and shells clung to her white night shift. When I lifted her up, water spouted from her mouth. Dead. She could not have had a whiter skin than when she lived. She was dead. But still, I tried to revive her.
I was overwhelmed with shock and horror. I felt I was in some way instrumental to her death. I crouched over the sea-gone wet doll in an attitude I knew to be a cruel parody of my own the previous night. My lips pressed to